Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUS Cast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss Relentless Incorporated versus Department of Commerce and Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, which were both argued before the Supreme Court on January 17, 2024. It is my honor to introduce our guest today, John J. Vecchione. John is Senior Litigation Counsel at New Civil Liberties Alliance, and he is the counsel of record for Relentless. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to our guests to summarize how the case got to the Supreme Court and to discuss the oral arguments.
All right. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. And I want to thank the Federalist Society. This is always, I think, useful for anyone who has an interest in the Supreme Court. These are always a good opportunity to ask questions which you wouldn't normally get. So we had two cases argued before the Supreme Court, Relentless versus Commerce, which was our case at New Civil Liberties. It was argued by Roman Martinez of Latham & Watkins. And then there was the Loper Bright case, which was brought by my old friends at Cause of Action, and that emerged from the D.C. Circuit. Ours emerged from the First Circuit and was argued by Paul Clement. The way it worked, which is a little unusual, was that we went first and we had regular argument. Then this Justice Jackson, who was recused because she had heard the oral argument of Eric Bolander of Cause of Action in the D.C. Circuit, and they normally recuse in those circumstances. So it was an 8-member bench when Loper Bright came up. But the questions were continuous from one argument to the next. One interesting thing the Supreme Court did in this case was allow all the amici briefs in Loper Bright to be read in Relentless. I think they saved a lot of trees that way. So we had our own amici as well, but anybody who filed in Loper Bright, it's in our case. So that's the setup of how the two cases worked. And now I just want to give a slight synopsis of what the cases were about and what the question presented was to the court. I think most people tuning into this will have some idea, but just to put us all on the same page. Loper Bright was filed in the District of Columbia, and their clients were fishermen primarily from New Jersey, Cape May, New Jersey, herring fishermen. And in the Loper Bright case, the district court had found that the text was clear that the agency was allowed to put at-sea monitors. There are people who go on the boat and count fish and make sure everything's being, all the rules are being followed, that sort of thing. They could put these at-sea monitors on the herring boats, and they could charge. They could force each of those boats, which are all small businesses, to enter into contracts with at-sea monitors who do nothing for the boats. They only report to the government information the government wants. These are not, even though they're making more than fishermen in a lot of cases, they are not doing anything for the boat. They're a burden to the boat. And the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which is at issue, was amended in 1990 to say that observers, each boat could be forced to carry observers. And these, the courts have determined these are a subset of observers, kind of observer. But they didn't say who paid for it. But for 20 years, the federal government paid for observers. They appropriated money. And that appropriation paid for the observers. The agencies and National Fisheries and NOAA and Commerce kind of all work on this. They all determined that they wanted more of these monitors. So they made at-sea monitors who have slightly less training than the former observers. And they were going to force the herring boats to carry them and pay for it. And it's nowhere in the statute. And in fact, there are three places in the statute that has cost shifting to the industry. And it's not in the New England herring fishery. So, but the DC District Court judge said, oh, yes, it's clear. And that's the only one, because it went up to the DC Circuit and they said, no, this is ambiguous. And they went through all the step one processes and they used all the candidates. And that is ambiguous. So we're going to use Chevron, and under Chevron, surprise, government wins. So that is the posture. It went up out of DC to the Supreme Court with the question, should the Supreme Court overrule or modify Chevron? There was a question that, what does Chevron apply if the statute's silent? But the Supreme Court took that question. In the First Circuit, where we were in Relentless, the District Court also found it ambiguous. Chief Judge Smith went through it in an opinion with a lot of fish puns. And he went through the statute. He found it ambiguous. He did almost the exact same analysis as the DC Circuit did. But he didn't have the benefit of that. That hadn't happened yet. But it goes up to the First Circuit, and the First Circuit said, well, under step one or step two, they didn't do the analysis that the Supreme Court keeps saying in both these arguments you're about to hear about that you're supposed to do. But they said, yeah, go ahead and do that in the First Circuit. So we petitioned for cert. And because of how brilliant my petition for certiorari was, they took our case as well. And I'm sure the fact that Justice Jackson was recused in Loper Bright was not as important as how brilliant that petition was. But in all seriousness, they wanted the opportunity to have a 9-member bench, so they took the case. And so it gets to the Supreme Court, two cases: should Chevron continue or should it be overruled? And they denied taking any question, either for Loper Bright or for us, on any other matter. We wanted, in Relentless, I wanted the necessary and appropriate language of the Magnuson-Stevenson Act to be, I wanted them to say that is not another license for the agencies to do whatever they want. They didn't take that. But there were a lot of questions about that sort of thing. So that's how the cases come. Our clients are also herring fishermen, but they fish on freezer boats, and they fish for things like the two kinds of squid and butterfish. So they're not just herring fishermen. And this regulation hit them, I think, worse than anyone, because they're freezer boats, they stay out at sea for 10 to 14 days rather than 3 or 4 days. So they've got these guys on their boat for a longer period of time. And sometimes they're not even fishing for herring, but they've got their herring monitor aboard. So they're paying for this very expensive guy, $710 a day, out of revenues from some other fish that isn't monitored. So it was extremely burdensome for the client, and we were hit very bad by this regulation that is nowhere in the statute. Because the last thing I want to say about how it got here is that when this was amended in 1990, as far as I can tell, nobody opposed putting observers on the boats. Certainly my clients didn't. I haven't seen any of the Loper Bright clients. Nobody said we were not going to take observers. That's not what this is about. 20 years later, the agency makes up this at-sea monitors being paid by the fishermen, and it's nowhere in the statute. So the problem is you'd have no chance to oppose this law. So we get to the Supreme Court, and it was a very, very hot bench. I put in my notes that Thomas asked the first question, which is his first question is we had a constitutional argument. I think that we focused on, neither party disagreed with the other party on any matter of law, but we were focused more on the Constitution rather than the APA. because there's lots of reasons Chevron's bad. And our reasons were Article 3, judges say what the law is, not agencies, and also due process in that you're in litigation with a party that's telling the judge what the law is. And that is the unfairness of that should be manifest in our view. And so Thomas's first question was, is any deference allowed under Article 3? I think that's what he was getting at. And so he was looking ahead, and a lot of these questions I'm gonna show are good just because everyone's asking what happens when we overrule Chevron. What comes next down the line? And I thought as I listened to all those questions that even people who weren't giving the game away were kind of giving the game away. I'm heartened by the fact that they wanted to know what happens in the absence of Chevron. And all the justices asked those questions, I'm pretty sure. But certainly Thomas did. Do we have to get rid of all deference? And then I'll just go through the justices because they asked the same type of questions of Roman in Relentless as they did for Paul and Loper Bright. But the other, then Kagan came out of the gate, and I put in my notes, well, she came to fight because she loves expertise. She loves the agencies having the ability to move this way and that. And she does not believe that some legal questions are binary. And so she peppered Roman with those questions. She later did it to Paul as well. And I think they showed that there really is a difference between law and policy. But Kagan was unshakable on that. Gorsuch jumped in and he played his hand open. He does not like Chevron. It's known since he was on the circuit court. He didn't like it. He's put it in there. And yesterday was no exception. He explained, I think, in the most poignant terms, and I think you'll be seeing a lot of this because it's true and because it's something that doesn't get said a lot. He said, I and other appellate judges see that Chevron is for agency capture. If an industry has captured the agency, they like it. But in Social Security, disability, the disabled don't capture agencies. Veterans don't capture the agencies when they're trying to get the ones trying to get benefits. And immigrants certainly can't capture agencies. And all these people are routinely hurt by agency, deferring to agencies for a position that is not the best reading of the law. And Gorsuch was very clear on it. And I would add fishermen are another one who don't control agencies. Justice Jackson, very worried about judges making policy decisions. She thinks that there is a democratic need to have an elected branch make these decisions, and she is fearful that elective branches won't be making policy if you get rid of Chevron. We respond to that. We certainly don't believe that's the case, but that's what happened. Barrett and Alito, I'm going to use their questions together because they're kind of interesting. Barrett is, tell me what happens. What's the difference between law and policy was her first question, sort of riffing off Jackson. She wants to know where the lines are, and she wants to know from her other questions, what's going to happen when Chevron's gone and how big a deal is this? The chief also, how big a deal is this? How often is it used? And both Roman and Paul just told the lower courts use it all the time, and they don't use it the way you people are saying about all this rigor. And I think the fact that the First Circuit had no rigor at all is a good fact for the side that wants to explain to the court that Chevron has failed below. It's failed as a doctrine. And so Alito went back to, well, why do we have Chevron? Why was it so great? Why was it so important? And why, if we get rid of it, it will be okay now? Answer to that question was, now the whole court is textualist and originalist. You're not allowed to make up policy as you were in the 60s and 70s. The way I always put it is that, you know, judging in the 60s and 70s, a lot of things came out, bell bottoms, pet rocks, that didn't stand the test of time. And I think that type of judging that Chevron was meant to correct is out the window now. So, and then Sotomayor wanted to know about stare decisis. Both she and Kagan were very big on what happens to all these cases. What happens to all the cases that have relied on Chevron? Are they all, is it all a jump ball? Do we all have to do it again? And the chief was concerned about that too. The answer is no, they're statutory interpretations, and the court is very strong that however a statute was defined by the court, it's going to stick, except under Brand X. And I'll end with this aspect of it, because I think I know there'll be questions, and I can get to what all the other justices did through questions. But Brand X came up, and if those of you may know that Brand X is a ruling which allows the agency to make one ruling on what the law is, what the law requires, and then a court to say, rule on it and say if it's right or wrong. And then the agency then can make another ruling and the court has to follow their ruling. They can actually change a court decision. And I was very close, and it looked to me, you can't hear the justice, but it looked to me like Sotomayor turns to Thomas, and they're having a, I think, it seems to me from the time of the questions that she was saying, here I am defending your opinion because Thomas wrote it. And I think he was saying, don't defend me. And Gorsuch gets in and they all start laughing. I mean, it was a nice moment, but Brand X got no love, not even from the Solicitor General. Solicitor General Prelogar was her normal, tremendous advocate. She was hitting these things hard, but even on, I don't think she would gave a full court press for Brand X. There was no love for that case from anybody. So where does it stand? It stands where we think that it was a very favorable day. You don't know exactly what's going to happen. There are concerns. But I think it's going to be a big case come May or June.
Thank you for the summary of the case and the oral arguments, John. The first question I have is whether a decision in favor of the fishermen potentially jeopardizes other federal regulatory programs that mandate the presence of on-site regulators with provisions provided for them, such as federal meat inspection agents or air marshals.
So this case is not about getting rid of observers. It's a matter of who pays for it. So nobody, neither the Loper Bright folks or we, have ever opposed having monitors, observers. Because it's a government job, the government should pay for it, except even in the Magnuson-Stevenson Act, it has a fee-based program in the Northern Pacific. Some of you may watch The Most Dangerous Catch, right? It's the most productive and profitable fishery in the world up there. And Congress made the decision that those observers would be paid by a fee-based mechanism they put in. Foreign fishermen, because they're going to be gone, and Kagan pointed this out, she says they're going to leave, so those observers are put on those boats and they have to contract those observers or have fee shifting. None of those observers are going to go. They're all going to be on the ships. They're all going to be looking at fish. There's a thing called a lap where all the fishermen split the catch in a certain area. Those are also a fee-based mechanism. And as Paul Clement pointed out, all of those have caps on how much they can charge the fishermen because Congress was really looking at it. But all of them can go in. Same with air marshals. If the statute says they're paid by the industry, that doesn't have a Chevron problem. The problem is when the agencies are trying to get away from congressional power, because in these cases, they're getting away from the appropriations power. They're getting away from the lawmaking power. They are trying to escape congressional control, and that's not what we want. So all of the regimes that have inspectors paid for by the government will still exist, and the observers, like in the Magnuson-Stevenson Act in Alaska and Alaska waters, they'll still have it as well. Congress said so. This doesn't put any of those regulations in danger.
The next question I have is multi-part. What would be the benefit of getting rid of Chevron? Would new cases be available to push back against agency decisions? And what are major industry areas where you expect new litigation to follow if Chevron is overturned?
So much of what's good about getting rid of Chevron, we'll never see. And here's what it is. the agencies, the bureaucrats themselves will not do something like this. They won't go, hey, how do we get around all the powers of Congress and what the words say? And how do we write a law that we want that we can't get through Congress and then just show a court that it's a reasonable interpretation of those words? You're going to see a lot less freelancing by the agencies, by the bureaucrats, because they know that they will have to make this argument to the court. The statute requires or allows this. Not the statute doesn't say I can't do this, right? So those incentives are going to mean that a lot of bad and oppressive administrative agency regulations are not going to be tried. And we won't see that. We won't know. But I think it's a good thing that'll happen. In litigation, once again, the question is will not be, the government will not be saying to you when you're in a suit with them, oh, we found ambiguity, and now our view has to be the law because we found some ambiguity and we've convinced the court there's ambiguity. The question for a judge should not be, is this ambiguous? It should be, what does this law say? And so they'll go back to that. So I have stressed very strongly in my writings and my statements on this, that Chevron makes every actor in our tripartite system act badly. It makes Congress not write clear laws because they figure, oh, there's an ambiguity. If my guy's in the White House, then I can get a law I could never get passed just by putting ambiguity and making an agency do it. Or if it's something I don't like, I can say, hey, I didn't write that. So it gets rid of congressional responsibility. It makes the agency and the executive think they can do everything, that they've got congressional and executive power and that they can't be stopped by the citizens who are affected. And it makes judges lazy, so they don't do everything they have to do to determine what the law says. So what I think you'll get is better actions by every part of our tripartite government if we get rid of Chevron.
The next question concerns Chevron and stare decisis. Does Chevron itself receive stare decisis respect? Why or why not?
That's a great question. I believe that Chevron does not deserve stare decisis effect, certainly not strong stare decisis. Strong stare decisis is its strongest in the statutory context. If the Supreme Court has told you what a statute means, very unlikely to overturn it. Case I love, and the reason I really think that all these Chevron-based statutory interpretations are not going to be overturned is an international baseball, which is a case from the 20s, where the Supreme Court, even in the 20s, with Babe Ruth running around, they determined that baseball was a local activity and it wasn't subject to the antitrust laws. And nobody thinks that's right. Baseball is a big business. They're all over the place. Nobody thinks it right. But it went back 50 years later to the Supreme Court, and Justice Stevens, who wrote Chevron, wrote this whole pan to baseball and how it's emerged under this thing. And they didn't overturn it then. It's never been overturned. They love statutory stare decisis. This isn't that. Constitutional law, when they've made a real bad constitutional error, this court feels that they can overturn it. And there's strong stare decisis people like Justice Kagan, and there's weaker like Justice Thomas, but they all think it has some effect. Here, this is neither a constitutional ruling nor is it a statutory ruling. It's how the court interprets things, how they actually go about doing the law. And that is totally in their wheelhouse. And so I think that they've changed how they look at things. Antitrust law, Paul Clement brought up the fact that you don't have implied causes of action anymore. They've done all this stuff without even mentioning stare decisis. And I think Chevron's in that bucket.
The next question I have is, why won't people who lost previously under Chevron come back to the court if they are still experiencing harms?
So they lost. There was a regulation put in. It got upheld under Chevron. Why won't they get after? Well, I have a number of reasons for that. First, I believe those will be stare decisis. The ruling of the court on that regulation, whether it applies to that, whether the statute allows that, is going to be a stare decisis. So there's going to be an impediment there. The other one is, look, We brought a case, a cause of action called the Gayful case, about this exact same issue in the mackerel fishery. And under the Magnuson-Stevenson Act, if you don't challenge a regulation 30 days after it's promulgated, the statute of limitations ran out. First Circuit told us statute of limitations ran out. Well, no fisherman was bothered by this law because the agencies kept delaying it. They put it, they issued it, and then they said, oh, it's not going to apply. It's not going to apply until the statute of limitations was gone many, many years. So there'll be a lot of statute of limitations, and there will be new regulations that'll come out, and those will then be adjudicated without Chevron. So I think that there might be a couple of cases where they try to overturn something, but I think they'll be swiftly disabused of that.
If the court chooses to limit Chevron instead of fully overturning it, what would the limiting principle be?
Whoa. Let me think about that. So, from the last question, General Preligar was arguing chaos to the court. She was saying, it's going to be chaos. And I don't think it will be. But the now you've brought into question is, if they don't get rid of Chevron, there was a lot of talk yesterday of Kaiserizing Chevron. And the Kaiser case kept our deference, which is the deference a court owes an agency about what its own regulations mean. And Kaiser has one thing that comes to mind, and our deference has one thing that comes to mind that Chevron doesn't have, and which sort of dovetails into Kagan and certainly Sotomayor's view. And that's this: you have to show agency expertise was involved. They exercised it, and you got agency expertise. They could limit Chevron to only times when the agency has expertise. In this case, you know, the agency has no expertise. Who pays is a congressional question. That's what they do. That's what they argue about up there. All, you know, Dirksen used to say, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that fellow behind the tree. That the fact is, that's what they're arguing all the time. Who pays? That's not something an agency has special knowledge of. They could do that. I think that'd be not useful because then we'd be going, oh, is this expertise? That not expertise? I also think that the silence issue sort of dropped out. No one really asked about it. Both advocates said that that's the question they took. No one wanted to do that. So I'm hoping against Kaiserization, but I think many of the things they'd have to do this line drawing. And the question of what's law and what's policy was big. It would be a return to that.
For our last question today, John, will the court overturn Chevron 6-3?
We'd love 6-3, but what they're going to say about Chevron right now, I do think that they're poised to get rid of the doctrine or vastly, change it. But both Barrett and the chief keep their cards extremely close to the vest, so you're not even sure they're playing poker. So I can't predict those two. I think I'm very sure Justice Kagan likes Chevron the way it is. Justice Sotomayor likes it the way it is. Justice Gorsuch is like Chevron delenda est. And then I can't tell you exactly where the rest of them exactly are. Because Alito asked a lot of questions about why we had Chevron, showing that there were benefits to it. He wasn't as hostile as for Gorsuch to the why Chevron was here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental power is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.